As a climber, have you ever considered the what if? What if I fail? What if I fall? What if I deck? And worst thought ever, what if I can't climb anymore? The mind can forecast all these scary things. However, they are just thoughts most of the time. Well, most of the time. In medicine, there's a model of healthcare called the biopsychosocial model, and that encompasses someone's biology, psychology, and social factors, and how they work together and influence someone's sense of well-being. In the circumstances when an individual receives a physical injury, the majority of the attention is focused towards the biology, which includes tissue healing, nutrition, rest, and getting back to movement. However, all individuals' recovery are multifaceted and multifactorial. In 2016, in the British Journal of Sports Medicine, there was an article published discussing how psychosocial factors are associated with outcomes of sports injury amongst competitive athletes. These psychosocial factors can be associated with good or bad return to sport outcomes. So, long story short, an injured athlete's thoughts, feelings, and actions may influence the outcome of rehabilitation. Having social support, decreasing daily stressors, and having a strong sense of self may prepare the best environment for our bodies to recover. The following story that you'll hear is of a fall and recovery sustained by a Denver climber and a friend of mine. He'll discuss what kind of support he had and how he trusts the recovery process in order to get back into climbing. I hope you enjoy.
My name is Steve.
You?
Okay, so I started climbing in high school at Devil's Lake, Wisconsin. And then I went to college, like you said, got into climbing much more, quote-unquote, seriously. You know, journeyed west as a young man after college with my now wife.
Right.
So we live in Denver, climbed all over the country, in various kind of types of climbing. And then the most relevant, I guess, would be last year, 2017, I was lowered off the end of the rope. I fell about 25 feet, landed on my back, broke many things, and have since rehabbed back into a functional human being.
And the fall happened?
Yeah, October 22nd, 14 months. Yeah, wild. It's been a very odd year.
Does it feel kind of surreal?
Yeah, it feels like it happened a million years ago, and it feels like it happened yesterday at the same time.
I didn't ask you to read the article, but the article that I'm kind of connecting with this podcast is talking about the psychosocial factors of rehab and learning about tissue healing times. Bones take a couple weeks to a month, muscles weeks to months, and ligaments like weeks to years. And I'm more intrigued about the recovery of the mind and not trying to step on any toes of like the psychology, you know, aspect of the medical profession, but understanding like how, as a future PT, how do we go about rehabbing an individual from such a traumatic fall or an experience? And so I would like to know, what was your level of climbing? Like what was the climbing grade you were at previous to your fall? And then now that you are climbing again, where are you at now?
Okay. I think previous to fall, sport, like red pointed a lot of 513s and V9. And at least in gym climbing, I'm back to 513 and V9.
I think that's incredible. And we'll talk about what specific injuries that you got from the fall. I do like it how it's like the ominous, the fall. that's the part I'm most intrigued about, is how you were able to get back to that prior level of competition, in a sense, like that your athleticism. And so can we talk about the day of the fall? So you got lowered off, you fell 25 feet on your back, you broke many things. What things did you break?
I broke 23 things.
Okay.
7 ribs and 16 spine pieces. And a lung. So okay. I had a large hemopneumothorax.
Okay.
Which is the potentially life-threatening.
Yeah, it was an epic tale. Because you guys were in alpine country?
No, it's an area called the South Platte.
Okay.
It's like a large geographic region, kind of southwest of Denver.
Mm-hmm.
And getting there is a little bit scrambly at times. So the rescue was pretty involved.
Okay.
I'm told there were, 30 plus people there.
Damn.
I was conscious for it. I wasn't counting people.
Right.
And so I got placed in a litter and I got lowered down a series of ropes. It took about 6 hours to get from the time of impact to get me to the road.
Okay.
And then, I was flown in a helicopter to actually the hospital that I work at.
Oh,
St. Anthony's Hospital. Hey, shout out. and everyone really did an amazing job. So,
okay.
That needs to be said.
So then did they take you straight to surgery? What was the kind of the medical decision making of how to make you, safe again?
Yeah. So I didn't go straight to surgery. I went to the ER first for imaging.
Okay.
Like you said, I'm a nurse. Mm-hmm. I used to work ER, and mm-hmm. now I do ICU, but I was pretty sure I had dropped a lung, that I had a pneumo.
Mm-hmm.
And so the treatment for that is a chest tube, which isn't really a surgery. It just happens at the bedside. They put one in. And so I thought that would happen, and I'd be in the hospital for a couple of days or something.
Right.
I didn't realize I'd broken all my spine. So that was a little more serious.
Did they tell you what segments?
Yeah, so I had a lot of the breaks were sort of inconsequential. Mm-hmm. They're like spinous processes and transverse processes. But I had, I believe, 5 vertebral body fractures. And so those were a lot more important. And the big nasty ones were T6, T7. And those were unstable burst fractures. So I had a lot of bone displacement into the spinal canal. And that posed the risk of paralysis.
Right. Did you have any symptoms at all? Did you have any numbness, tingly?
No, never. No neurologic symptoms, which is pretty amazing, I guess, given the extent of the injury. Through the whole process, I was sort of like an ER nurse about it.
Okay.
I was like, oh, a lot of people break their backs and it's terrible. And I didn't take it lightly, but, it's fixable. Right?
Okay.
And my surgeon really corrected me after the fact. He said, no, I still don't know why you're not paralyzed. You should be, given the amount of bone fragment in your spinal column.
Wow.
Yeah, and then he was like, you haven't seen the imaging, have you? And he showed me the MRI and the CAT scan and stuff. And he said he'd only had one other person in his, 11 years with that much damage that wasn't paralyzed. That was a pretty emotional follow-up visit because I didn't realize how close I was to that. But backtracking a little bit, so I went to ER, went through imaging. They saw the pneumo first, and it was quite large. It ended up being a couple liters of blood, plus a bunch of air. So they had to put a chest tube in pretty quickly. And then thereafter, they took me back to MRI.
Okay.
To find out all the specifics related to the spine. And then I had to go to surgery pretty quickly thereafter. It was right around midnight or 1 a.m. that I made it to surgery. But yeah, so 7-level fusion, which essentially fixed it. And then after that, it was just, quote unquote, just the rehab.
What was the, after surgery, whether if it was your surgeon or the rehab team, what was the prognosis of returning to activity or sport or life?
It was good. They pulled things. They decompressed my spinal area.
Right.
And then, the surgeon was like, from a spinal standpoint, you'll be able to function normally again.
Wow.
It's just going to take the better part of a year.
Okay.
To get you there. Which is, it's kind of hard to believe when you're, I was laying in the ICU bed, I had a chest tube, I'm on oxygen. I hadn't walked yet, and to imagine that you'd be back to, walking, but much less, being an athlete, as relative as that is.
Wow.
But it's hard to believe when you're in that situation. And then I'd say it got even harder, like, later on. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of restrictions. Because, like you say, it's 8 weeks for bone growth or so. And so I had a 12-week activity restriction. I couldn't lift more than 10 pounds. I had a full cervical thoracic brace that I wore. I had really had to let that fusion solidify first, or you could do major damage. And then at the 12-week mark, I could start physical therapy. Yeah, and that was a real low point at the end of that 12 weeks, because I had done nothing but walk, and, you know, they cut through all your back musculature, and you're weak and atrophied, and everything feels terrible.
Yeah.
It was really hard to believe that I could be an athlete again.
So, you talked about that low point. What got you out of it?
There were a lot of things. I was super lucky that I had a ton of support, my wife in particular, but also coworkers and friends really went above and beyond.
So what were some of the things, like, for someone who, God forbid, hopefully no one gets a traumatic injury, but what were some of the support things that they did that you felt supported, that you know that you're going to be better for it?
Man, so many things. I mean, it was like, just like, taking care of the day-to-day, you know, like, that allowed me to do the things I had to do to
heal,
repair, and heal. Right. Yeah, so, like, I mean, at that time, you know, I came home on oxygen even after a week in the hospital because I had a lot of lung injury, and I was sleeping, like, 14 hours a day or more, you know, and I'd lost a lot of blood, and this was in the winter, so I was always cold, you know. You know, people brought us food. They helped support Chris. When the accident happened, we had a 3-year-old and a 1-month. So take that,
wow.
Wife, Kristen. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Way to go, Chris, like, wife of the year.
Yeah, no kidding. And that was a huge part of it. Like, she told me early on, like, you know, I've got this. We will handle it.
Wow.
And, like, you will be better, and, like, you know. And it was hard for me. Like, I was used to being a very contributing member to our family, right? And I went from that to being an utter dependent, right? So Kristen had, like, went from 1 dependent, 3-year-old, to, like, 3 dependents, you know, 3-year-old, 1-month-old, and husband. You know, and in this time, like, our water heater went down. So we had all these, like, other things
come up. Life happened.
Yeah, and, like, people just, they came over and they like, a friend, 2 friends, like, replaced our water heater. People brought us food. Like,
wow.
Stuff just happened, you know. It was absolutely amazing. It's like looking at your own funeral, you know. Like, to see that kind of support is, like, indescribable, almost. Like, here I am trying to describe it. But it's incredible. I still have, like, a sense of awe from it, you know. So really it just freed me to do what I had to do, right? Like, whether it be like passive movement once I got to that point, for range of motion, like,
yep,
in my neck, or walking. We have another mutual friend, Ben, who's also a PT. Mm-hmm. He came out when I came home from the hospital, and he's like a big guy too. And he could help me walk. And I mean, my first walk was utterly pathetic. Like, I made it, like, to the sidewalk out our front door and started shivering uncontrollably, and I, like, came back in and I was wiped.
Yeah. But how good did that feel though?
That one felt horrible. Subsequent walks felt really good.
Got it. Okay.
And, you know, right, setting little PRs, like, you know, a few days later I made it to the corner of the block or something. And that was like, okay, like, I can walk again, you know?
Nice.
You know, and then eventually it was like building up speed and stamina and stuff like that, which, you know, seems kind of pathetic now, like, looking back on it. But I feel like that sort of goal related behavior helped a ton too. You know, I had the advantage going in because I work with open heart patients, and we, you know, they have this massive surgery, but we get them up and walk them the next morning.
Right.
And so I had the advantage of understanding, like, the importance of mobility.
Right.
And the importance of lung training. So I was attached to my incentive spirometer,
mm-hmm,
my flutter valve, and I did it religiously. And, you know, and I still remember, like, the first time I tried it, I could pull, like, 300 mil. And that's terrible for, right, someone my size. And I actually just found it a couple months ago in the basement where it cleaning, and I can pull it up to over 5,000. Which is good.
Booyah!
You know, yeah. And I remember the milestones along the way. It was huge. Yeah, there was a lot of... Yeah, it was like... When you're kind of, like, immediately broken, it was like, well, I want to get back to this. That's, like, my motivation, sort of the proverbial carrot.
Right.
For all the pain that you'll go through. there were certainly bigger motivators too. Just like I wanted to be able to lift up my son.
Right.
And hold him.
That'd
right?
be really good.
And think, yeah, and be a dad again, like wrestle with, you know, that kind of thing. Mm. But the climbing was just assumed. And it kind of went that way all the way until I could do it. So, I did the 12 weeks of nothingness, of walking. And then I did my PT for, I think, 6 weeks.
Okay, well, we're just not to go into so much specifics, but was that just trying to get mobility back and trying to get strength back and just in
yep.
general? Okay.
Yep. Yeah, and proper mechanics.
Okay.
A brief aside, so previous to all of this, I was actually supposed to have a microdiscectomy in yep. my lumbar spine.
Wow.
And I had previously, this summer, just prior to the accident, I had done a lot of PT to get proper spine mechanics to try to rehab that disc.
Yeah.
And it worked. So I ended up not needing that surgery to reduce the disc so I could do PT. But anyway, it gave me a really good understanding of spine mechanics, or not really good, but like a basic understanding of spine
yeah.
mechanics to begin with. And that helped a ton too. So trying to like maintain proper alignment and movement. But anyway, during that time, I got cleared to go climb, and I did, and it felt terrible. You know, I felt like I was going to tear in half.
Explain. So you got the okay to climb. Did you go outside first? You go to the gym first?
I went to the gym the first night I was cleared.
So did you decide to boulder first, rope up?
Oh, yeah. No, so I roped up,
and
I remember doing a 5.7
okay.
on vertical terrain.
Yep.
Just jugs everywhere.
Okay.
And it was so hard, and I had, there's a lot of scar tissue in the back, and it just felt literally like I was tearing. And I probably was, like, breaking up a lot of scar tissue, which is
adhesions, which is good.
Good.
Yeah. How is the mind, because the last time you went on a wall and you were lowered off of it and causing injury, did you have that fear, that overwhelming, like, consummation of like, holy crap, this could happen again?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Okay.
Less than I thought would be. I was on the auto belay. It was like late at night, you know, I just like ran off to the gym. You know how when you like let go on an auto belay,
there's like a slight
lag before
yeah.
it catches you.
Yeah.
So I tried that like right on the ground several times. I was like, okay, this works. and so the climbing part, it didn't cross my mind a whole lot. It was always like when lowering, like when the actual accident occurred. And that was actually worse slightly when I was getting belayed. You know, I always made sure my belayer knew what happened and like lower me really slowly and like smoothly. Because the feeling that triggers that is actually like when you're hanging on the rope, and if someone like let the rope through quickly for a second and you feel that drop, that was like the feeling that happened with my accident, except it didn't stop, it just went all the way.
Right. Yeah, it's just like your brain imprinted that feeling into like, this causes damage.
Yeah. So the reptile brain is like fear. And so that's the time where I still feel that. And then, so I climbed and it was whatever. And I started climbing again and things were working, getting better and feeling physically less awful. But around that time, you know, my wife and I were still talking a lot about it, and we had the really scary conversations that one would about, you know, because like dying was very possible in this, and like as was being paralyzed was probable,
right?
According to the surgeon. And so, you know, we had the really awful conversations, and I started reflecting a lot more. And I was like, okay, well, I'm back. I can climb. I have. It's fine. But like, should I? You know, like my
right.
kids almost didn't have a dad. Is this like an acceptable risk in my life and my wife's life? And that, I took a step back for several months
okay.
after that.
Okay.
And that was sort of probably the hardest part of all of it, psychologically.
In the sense of what? Where it's like, you step back in the sake of, for your family? And like,
yeah.
And how does that not honor yourself because you have identified yourself as being a climber from such a young age? And like kind of reestablishing what climbing is to you? It's almost like a self-identity.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. It is a huge part of me. I used to do other things before kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was more like, I don't, you know, maybe like bicycling would be a more proper pursuit for like a dad or something. I don't know. It was hard to say. And then I say yes, it was for my family, but it was also for me because I wanted to be present for their milestones. Like the thought of missing, you know, Quinn learning to walk, that's my youngest daughter,
yep.
Or what, like all those little, like not little, all those big things and little things, like was really sad to me, you know? And so during this time, like when I told Kristen, my wife, this, she was shocked. She just assumed I would go back to climbing, and she totally supported me in doing so.
So we have this biopsychosocial model of healthcare, and it's the idea of holistically approaching each individual with those three pillars. So like we have this tissue healing, the biology, and you are set. You have the psychology of how the mind is and the fear response, and you're able to learn and grow with it and be able to back to climbing. And now you're like kind of talking about the social aspect of how you participate in your community.
Right.
And so I think that to me is fascinating about how we need all three of those, not just the physical body, but the mind and our relationships with the outside world to help us become who we are.
I totally agree.
So then so after you took a step back, what did you figure out?
Well, I mean, I would say it's still ongoing.
Yeah.
But overall, we decided that, you know, life is risky, right? None of us are getting out of this alive. And so that climbing is indeed like a reasonable risk.
What do you think to like someone who's getting into the climbing or even the climber who's been climbing for years to manage those risks?
Great question. I mean, you know, all the things like...
It's like it's more risky to get into your car than actually roping up. We get that.
Right, statistically. Yeah, I mean, you know, so my accident in particular was like, it was sort of a specific set of circumstances where a lot of like small things coalesce to form like a big accident, right? And so, you know, any climbers who are listening, that, you know, why did you get lowered off the end of the rope? Like, why wasn't the system closed?
Right.
Where was the stop or not? And the answer is there was one, but that on the pitch previous to my accident, my partner followed, so she had to remove that stop or not to tie in. And then I think that she was newer to outdoor climbing, and this is sort of an outdoor-related accident,
right.
Where the rope is too short. The stop or not didn't get put back in, and I didn't check that. I'm used to climbing with people who know to do that, so that's like one piece, right? And then, you know, she's not used to looking at the end of the rope, right? When she's belaying, like, indoors, the rope is long enough typically, and
right.
So, like, it's like another piece, and then, like, it was my rope that I had cut, you know, because the ends wear out and you cut the rope and all this. And then, like, in my mind, I had put a stopper knot in, so it was fine. I could have just, like, re-threaded, you know, a couple bolts or whatever. And so, like, that oversight was, like, on me and, like, that part. And so there's, like, all these, like, seemingly small errors, right, that lined up.
Right.
And so, you know, double checks are always good. I would always double check, like, my tie-in and the belayer setup, but I didn't always check the stopper knot, right, that the system was closed every pitch.
Right.
And, you know, things like that. And then we're, like, measuring your rope, you know, because I thought it was, like, about a 70, and people assured me that the pitch would go with a 70, but it evidently was a little shorter. And so, yeah, just a lot of things like that. I mean, obviously learn your setups well and then double-check things and make it systematic, I'd say, is the biggest thing, so that those things happen.
Just kind of built in, like, a routine?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because I've certainly caught a lot of errors in double-checking data I set up and things
right.
like that. So that worked.
For sure.
I think the element of distraction is a big one too. So, and that was probably a part of mine too. Like someone was talking later while I was getting lowered,
yeah.
which is pretty common. But like, I think it adds an element of distraction potentially
yeah.
to, in medicine, actually we talk about quiet cockpit. We borrowed that from the airline industry. So below a certain altitude, when a pilot is landing a plane, like there's no extraneous chit chat, right? Like it's just business. You know, and so I think like adopting that mindset while belaying or tying in or any of that stuff is a good idea. So we use it in medicine too, what we're doing sort of like critical procedures or medication administration.
And so I think we're going to be kind of wrapping up soon. What would you say to a person who had an injury? And it doesn't have to be so traumatic like yourself. It could have been a muscle strain or a ligament sprain or like I hurt my finger and they really want to get back into climbing specifically, but any sport in general. Sure. From your experience, and we hope that no one has to, you know, follow your footsteps, what are some pearls of wisdom for someone who wants to really get back into the activities that they love?
Well, that's a big question. I think in my eyes, like you talked about, like the physical, the psychological
and the social.
So in my opinion, the physical follows the other two, right? So like if your mind is ready, like your body will do whatever you tell it, you know, and vice versa. If your mind isn't ready, it doesn't matter how healed you are,
right?
It just will not happen. And so for me personally, I drew a lot of strength in the process. Like I talked to others who had done this, I followed directions to a T from my surgeon, because they know, right?
Right.
They know how this goes. And so, like, at 12 weeks, he's like, all right, you can do things. Just let your body tell you if it's good or not. And I said, well, what about these things? What about these things? He's like, yeah, you can do all the things. Just, like, get into it slowly. Because I had that fear of re-injury, you know? But logically, I'm like, I know that the bone is healed, right? And, like, it's okay to do these things and just, like, build up. And that helped convince my mind. And then, you know, for me, the social support helped convince my mind, too. Like, all my friends and family, or, well, not all of them, but a lot of them were, they were like, well, yeah, you'll be a climber. You are a climber. That's part of what you do. It's okay. You know, you're, overall, you're a safe climber, despite what happened. And that helped convince me that it was okay. So, yeah, respect the process. And then, I think, like, give it the time it deserves up front. Right? And that will make the whole process shorter. So, like, in my case, it was like, let that fusion heal. Don't do anything except for walk or whatever. It goes 12 weeks, which is a long time. But then you know that it's healed. And then you can be more aggressive in PT thereafter. And you can push some. Whereas, like, if I had cheated and done stuff early, you know, you have the risk of re-injury, you have the risk of taking longer, your base isn't as solid.
A seed of doubt is planted.
Yeah, yeah. And I think especially with, like, soft tissue injuries, like ligaments, yep. There's always that worry there. But really, if you give it the time, the proper rest and rehab, like, you get stronger and you rest, right? Like, that is the most important part.
Thanks to the climbing doctor, Dr. Jared Vege, physical therapist, for his mentorship on how to best treat climbing injuries and allowing me to share this podcast through the social network. A thank you to my friend, Mikuri, whose assistance of helping me create a podcast and his original music allowed this to turn out a lot better than I hoped for. And finally, my biggest thank you is to my longtime friend Steve Dew and his beautiful family for allowing me to stay, interview Steve, and learn about his fall and his recovery. I appreciate always the free couch that I can crash on, even though Barnaby, the world's ugliest dog, tends to beat me to it. Thank you.